For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really happy to be able to welcome back into our studios for his monthly visit to the program, Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, author of After the Cold War, and a columnist whose columns appear in newspapers across the country. And he is also someone who makes regular appearances on WUWM, our public radio listeners to the north. And we'll be talking about an array of different topics and issues. And when our conversation is finished, we will be joining National Public Radio's coverage of the House hearings, House Select Committee hearings regarding the insurrection on January 6th. So that will be coming up a little bit later. But first, Dr. Art Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's a real tonic and a pleasure for me to be here. I always leave with something to think about. Whether anyone else does or not, I find it of great benefit. Thank you.
So is this a busy summer for you, or a little less busy than typical?
Well, it's good that things are reopening. I have the good fortune of having more time to pursue substantive in-depth writing beyond the weekly column, which I've become pretty good at grinding out. And I've never missed a deadline or a week, but more in-depth writing is more difficult. Once again, your program, as well as teaching at our fine college, is a real tonic, especially as one gets older.
Right. I know what you mean. Well, it's great to have you here. I was really appreciative of you for sending me this morning, or this morning is when I saw it, at least, your most recent column, which concerned the space exploits of Jeff Bezos and Richard Branson, which I'm sure a lot of our listeners have heard quite a lot about. And and you mentioned that in all of the attention given to Mr. Bezos and Mr. Branson, that not quite so much attention has been given to Elon Musk, who in some ways is an even more significant player in all of this.
Bezos would not agree with that. Branson might.
Right. The thing that was really interesting is I know that on a very personal level, I reacted to these two little space flights by Mr. Bezos and Mr. Branson as kind of ridiculous, as a extraordinary expenditure of money, and for what benefit, except to kind of glorify these two rich guys. And
very interesting.
I think I feel like, you know, I have plenty of friends who kind of greeted the news the same way. I mean, and I appreciated the fact that your column really tried to put this in a very different kind of context. It's given me something to think about. So what do you think is the worth of what Mr. Bezos and Mr. Branson have done?
Well, keep in mind they're using private capital, their own funds, quite literally. They're corporate funds, not public expenditure. The usual complaint about space travel is all this government money that could be spent on welfare and other things. This is private funds, which in that sense, no matter how far left one is, Professor, you should be applauding the fact that it's not a burden on the public purse, and you should tell your liberal friends the same.
I don't know that it has anything to do with being liberal or conservative.
Well, that's the usual argument. Yeah. We could be spending on the poor. We could be spending on greater equity and inclusion. We could be spending on all the social programs.
Right, right.
It's private money. Therefore, why are you so dismissive? We should be applauding using private money to go into space, shouldn't we?
Well, I guess that's the point that your column was trying to make. All I was trying to say is I initially greeted this as it just seemed like a vanity project, you know, with somebody who has so much money that they don't know what to do with it. So
I should be interviewing you, Professor. We should probe more deeply into why you have this kind of visceral reaction. I don't think the average person reacts like that. Neither you nor I are in a position to talk about the average American directly, and we'd be pretty arrogant if we did. However, I don't think that sentiment is widely shared. People have a fascination generally with space exploration.
That's true. I mean, I think, on the other hand, the millions and millions and millions of dollars that was spent on this, you know, again, at a glance, my reaction was, you know, what good did that do except it got Mr. Bezos up in space?
You think it was a stunt?
Well, I mean, that's just what it kind of felt like. I mean, as opposed to when NASA sends people into space, it seems like it is with scientific purposes in mind. And I don't know what kind of high-minded purpose there was in Mr. Bezos flying himself into space. I mean, in what way was that going to advance anything, any cause or any scientific breakthroughs or so on? It was just he has enough money to fly himself into space. And who benefited from that except Mr. Bezos? I guess that's the question. But I think your column, you know, kind of touches on some answers to that.
When the column puts things in historical context of a worthwhile sort, which I actually work very hard to do, a great criticism of the Moon Project, which President Kennedy very dramatically launched in 1961 to send a man to the surface of the moon, and the president was always careful to add, return him safely to Earth. That was achieved in 1969 during the Nixon administration, poignantly and ironically in different ways. A lot of criticism at that time was that this is a huge waste of money. President Eisenhower, whom I admire a lot, was strongly opposed to human space flight and space exploration. Instruments do the job much better. And that's self-evidently true, and that's been confirmed. Manned space flight, it was vastly more expensive and vastly more dangerous. All of that is true. There are lots of reasons why I think it was a good idea and why we generally applaud manned exploration of space and why NASA is now planning to go back to the moon for the first mission since 1972. A man and a woman, according to the current plan, will go to the moon in 2024, I think. All kinds of benefits, miniaturization. Every time you use your cell phone, sir, you're saying hello to President Kennedy, because that kind of miniaturization, it went well beyond the transistor, which World War II generated. Health benefits, biological knowledge of what's going on in the human body and what could go on. All kinds of ancillary benefits have resulted that have been beneficial. Our colleague Kevin Crosby, whom you should have on your program if you haven't had recently, thanks to his efforts and that of our fine students, we are the NASA institution for Wisconsin, not UW-Madison or Milwaukee, not the engineering school in Milwaukee, MSOE, but Carthage College. And we have available through our website and through Kevin a great deal of information about the values of the space program. So it's a good question. Sorry if I was too sarcastic, but you know what I'm like. But there are all kinds of benefits, plus the excitement. Politics and government, especially in a democracy, involve excitement, and the challenge is to channel it in positive directions.
Right. And your column, of course, among other things, outlined the significance of something that a lot of us Americans don't stop to think about, but really should, namely something I think called COMSAT, the satellite system that we wouldn't have now. And most of us don't stop to realize, and maybe don't begin to even understand just how significant it is in all kinds of facets of life.
Yes, transferring money, talking on your cell phone. We take it for granted, not just for commercial transactions, but for today, literally, all kinds of vast communication and sharing of information. In 1973, the banking industry, major commercial banks around the world, got together and decided to develop the SWIFT system, which is an acronym for the Global Transmission Electronically, using cables, but also satellites, not just paper letters of credit and transfer, but electronically to engage in banking, in other words. And I believe it's been in operation since 1977. Again, when you put down your cell phone and start moving money from one account to another, or paying the minimum on your credit card, or borrowing money electronically, you're using that system. Eisenhower, again, in 1960, put in place the preliminary plan, a very far-sighted move, for satellite communications. We already had rudimentary satellites in space. Manned space flight was coming. The Soviet Union was first in that part of the space race, Yuri Gagarin, in the spring of 1961. And as you have reminded me more than once on the air, the Soviets were also the first to put a woman in space. A few years later. Yeah, that's right. John Glenn, someone I happen to admire a great deal, I had the privilege of being around him a couple of times when I was young. John Glenn got into space from our side in 1962. We never lost anyone in space, unlike the Soviets, who sacrificed human beings and dogs and other creatures for the space race. The only casualties, almost unbelievably, in our program were Gus Grissom and two colleagues who were burned to death, incinerated on the ground in 1967. But we've never lost anyone in space, which shows just how capable human beings are when we put our collective minds to achieving something. Anyway, Ike put in place this basic foundation, given his own admiration for business executives and Republican propensities and philosophy. He geared that towards private communications, telephone and telecommunications companies. Kennedy really began to implement the program and took tremendous heat in the Democratic Party for not establishing a large New Deal-type public agency, but implementing and chartering a private corporation's COMSAT, the Communications Satellite Corporation. It was all private market activity. There was tremendous criticism of Kennedy from all kinds of quarters. The New Republic, which in the early 60s was a kind of hard-nosed anti-communist but liberal reformist journal. It's changed a lot, in my view, over the years and become more narrowly focused on Israel. The New Republic was scathing in criticism of Kennedy. However, that facilitated the tremendous commercial success that we've had, and again, exploited private capital, which was growing rapidly in the 60s.
I guess that's one thing that is probably important for us to acknowledge, is that when two rich people like Jeff Bezos or Richard Branson go into space, I mean, it seems like, I think part of why some of us react the way we do is because it's this private enterprise. It's not something that the rest of us feel like we're sharing in. But you're touching on the fact that private capital has always been in the mix.
Yeah,
you know, even when it was NASA going into space rather than such and such a billionaire.
Yeah, and rich men, and I add forcefully, rich women are constantly wasting their money privately, fun and games, sometimes notoriously, Monte Carlo. There are lots of ways to blow a fortune and more opportunities all the time. These gentlemen, I think, are doing something constructive. I'm a great admirer of Richard Branson. He emerged in the 70s. He's been around longer than Jeff Bezos, whom we all have to admire for his great business acumen. But Branson emerged at a time when Britain was in the doldrums. They really were in economic decline. Years of post-war socialism plus the end of empire meant it was a really beleaguered economy. And West Germany seemed to be emerging as the dominant force in Europe. I think we give Margaret Thatcher rightly a lot of credit for really forcing open a collectivist system for market economics, but Richard Branson deserves a lot of credit for seizing an airline deregulation, which President Carter deserves credit for implementing in this country and internationally, and pursuing low-cost travel and becoming an inspiring figure for the British and more generally. He's also a very decent manager, and I've spent some time studying his career because I was a grad student in Britain when he was emerging. Mm. He's really worth paying attention to as an entrepreneur who is also very, very sensible and humane in his treatment of workers, and has helped transform the British economy and inspire the people at a time when they really needed it over there.
Very good.
And, well, thank you. I'm glad you approve of that comment.
And the column, as we mentioned, touches on the contributions of Elon Musk. I want to add parenthetically, I aired recently an interview I did with Earl Swift about a really interesting book called Across the Airless Wilds, which examines a specific facet of the space program, namely the development of the lunar rover, which was a huge part of the last three manned missions to the moon, Apollos 15, 16, and 17. And one of the things that Earl Swift talks about is that there were actually massive budget cuts in 1968 that to some extent imperiled some of the Apollo plans and forced NASA to drastically rethink how they were going to do things. And for one thing, the original plan was to send up two rockets, one with the astronauts and the other with all kinds of hardware and so on. And they, because of these budget cuts, the decision had to be made for, nope, it's going to be just one rocket and everything has to go up at the same time. And one of the only things that remained from those more grandiose original plans was some kind of lunar rover. And this fascinating book explores how it was developed and some of the private companies that were instrumental in developing it.
So, what's the name of Earl Swift's book?
Across the Airless Wilds. Across the Airless Wilds. And my interview with Earl Swift aired a couple of weeks ago. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Art Sear, Colossian Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College. And we've been talking space, but now we're coming back to Earth to talk about important matters in several other countries, beginning with Cuba. Remind our listeners about what has been going on in Cuba and what has set off some important demonstrations actually in Washington, D.C., and calls for the United States to intervene in what's going on in Cuba.
Large-scale public demonstrations in Cuba itself, which I believe are unprecedented, certainly in terms of getting public attention. There's been unrest in Cuba before, but before the internet, the Castro brothers took over on New Year's 1959. So it predates the public internet. I'm sure there's been, I actually know there's been public unrest in Cuba. But I don't think anything that's been this widespread, given the extremely harsh and extraordinarily effective nature of Cuban intelligence and security forces, people are in my opinion, showing a lot of courage out of desperation. The basic necessities of life have been literally disappearing. Mm. Tourism and tremendous effort to encourage capital investment again have helped some. Fidel Castro retired. He died, I think, in 2016, about a decade before he'd retired. But then he reemerged in 2010, two rather ironically denounce the corruption and unproductive nature of the system that he and his enforcer brother Raul had put in place, the communist system. They confessed rather more dramatically than Deng Xiaoping in China in 1992. It's failed, so they opened the door to investment and a more open and fairly regulated market economy. Basically, the collapse of the Soviet Union, Cuba had become a dependent state of Moscow very quickly in the early 1960s, during the height of the Cold War, that ended the tremendous physical subsidies that were essential to keeping the Castro regime afloat economically. Venezuela, a radical regime, ideological fraternity between the two gangs in charge, in my opinion. They picked up some of the slack, but Venezuela itself is a basket case now. So Cuba is in desperate straits. Given our own pretty ugly history of dealing with Cuba, not just during the Kennedy administration, but historically, in my opinion, it's particularly important that we be restrained, certainly not intervene in any way militarily or directly politically. The regime, their knee-jerk reaction is to blame Yankee imperialism, which is what Radio Havana and everybody else in their controlled media is doing today. It's clearly increasingly absurd, and I think patience, containment, waiting, while doing what we can to reintroduce the Internet into Cuba, as President Biden has rightly emphasized, are our best course.
I think you had an interesting line towards the end of the column when you said, after saying we should avoid directly acting to overthrow the regime, you said we should support change from within. And you think this matter of kind of reinstating the Internet could be one factor in that.
And I think cultural, scientific, medical science especially is impressive and well-developed in Cuba. Eisenhower, again, during the height of the Cold War, we had ongoing scientific and cultural exchanges, which is why the Bolshoi Ballet was in New York City, and Louis Armstrong and Leonard Bernstein, the great classical composer as well as conductor, were in Moscow and other parts of the USSR. I think that kind of activity is all to the good. But we should not give in to the temptation to subsidize Cuba. There's been an embargo that only the United States, plus Israel, interestingly enough, have respected since 1960. The rest of the world has been willing to trade with Cuba. Look what it's done. A basically corrupt and rotten system is just, by its nature, unproductive. So we should do what we did with the Soviet Union and with other communist nations, patiently wait while containing them. Fortunately, they don't have the appeal that they did through the Cold War. Cuba was a genuine security threat to this country, I believe, up until the collapse of the Soviet Union, especially in parts of Central America and in Chile especially, which had close ties with East Germany, ironically reinforced by the exodus of Nazis during and following World War II. Containment, we have the high ground today strategically, and I think containment is our best course.
That sounds a little bit reminiscent of what you talk about in another column about China and the 100th anniversary of China's Communist Party, and that might come as a surprise to some people that the Communist Party has been alive and well in China that long, just because.
Yes, indeed.
I think for some of us, we think of communism in China beginning with Chairman Mao in the mid-1940s.
And, 1949, they took over the mainland.
Right. And so, you're talking about a history that's a little bit longer. Explain how that was celebrated in China, this milestone of 100 years of the Communist Party.
Well, speaking of big egos, whether in the corporate world who want to be transported to the edge of space or in a far different and malign way, the political world, the Castro brothers, especially Fidel, China is now ruled by an increasingly autocratic dictator who more and more is developing a personality cult around himself, Xi Jinping. I think that will ultimately be his downfall. I certainly hope so. But for the moment, the Communist Party, despite liberalizing their economy, again, quite dramatically, and carrying out an economic revolution in China, he is trying as assiduously as possible to reinforce tight control of the system, being much more threatening toward Taiwan, which remains independent and which could spark a war between us and them, imposing dictatorship on Hong Kong, which had some residual civil liberties, which the good British were very careful to put in place before they withdrew in 1997. But it's an increasingly autocratic and brutal regime. Mm. The persecution of the Uyghur minority is absolutely outrageous. A distinctive group, ethnically, religiously a religious group that is basically, I believe, Islamic in their approach. One of our very fine political economy students, Brianna Parks, did a splendid senior thesis on the Uyghurs and the international, the implications of that persecuted minority for international relations more generally, which really helped educate me last semester on the subject. Mm-hmm.
In your column about China, you talk about its economy and describe it in terms that make it sound quite robust and formidable. And indeed, you say they are flat out our big rivals at the moment on the global stage. Explain kind of what the state of affairs is with the economy in China and why it's kind of an interesting mix.
Well, more than Japan, where we really are structurally rivals, and in the 1990s, there was an intense anxiety in American politics and controversy about Japan. China's economy is much more complementary. Both Japan and the U.S. are highly advanced industrial nations, powerful in manufacturing, but more and more in terms of the labor force involved in services. China is going through a basic industrial revolution and provides a very talented and enormous and reliable workforce for basic manufacturing. In that sense, they're much more complementary than directly competitive economy for the U.S., defined as a nation. And I think we should keep that in mind. At the same time, they engage in widespread, not only national espionage, which all nations do, including us, and we should, but also in commercial espionage, a very casual approach towards intellectual theft, towards taking other people's intellectual property without compensation or even acknowledgement. That is a very, very serious problem where the U.S. has the high ground. I don't believe they in any way rival the United States at the moment, contrary to constant media and political drumbeating, especially in Washington.
Although, just to be safe, to be fair, in your column, you said, make no mistake, China is our rival.
Yeah.
But
in pure economic terms, I think it's in political and ideological and security terms that there's a rivalry, but they're not our enemy.
Right.
Yeah, I was going, thank you for bringing me back into focus.
And what is interesting in terms of the connection with your column on Cuba is when you say at the very end of your column, careful, calculated containment should guide our approach to China.
Exactly.
That sounds a lot like what you were saying about Cuba.
And it does. If you're going to have a market economy, you've got to have not the Bill of Rights necessarily, not anything like the U.S. Constitution in terms of the guarantees of liberty, but you have to have respect for contracts. And in fact, litigation is growing in China from the 1970s. Bob Abood, the very colorful, controversial CEO of First National Bank of Chicago, who was a very strong board member and a very helpful one for the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, where I worked. He, with great fanfare, Big Bob took their board of directors to China. That opened the door to an avalanche of lawyers from Chicago and everywhere else going to China to pursue investment, to pursue contracts. Litigation has been growing in China for decades, and of necessity, the communists have to have a fair and impartial commercial legal system. That's the great challenge for Xi Jinping, however enormous his ego and his success so far. the market undermines this kind of arbitrary total control by the state. In terms of total assets, when you again measure public and private assets and debts, the U.S. is far stronger than China, to the tune of like $70 trillion versus about $20 or $30 trillion insofar as you can measure. And that differential is growing. I don't mean to be complacent in any way, shape, or form. We have serious labor force problems in this country, which the Chinese have exploited in terms of drawing investment. But overall, we are extraordinarily powerful.
It's a good thing to remember.
Yeah, but the possibility of war is there. We never went to war with the Soviet Union or Russia, thank God, directly. We were, in fact, vital allies in World War II, as everyone knows. We did go to war with China and Korea. It was even by the terrible standards of war, it was an unusually brutal and ugly war until Eisenhower quite ruthlessly ended it soon after taking office. There is a real danger of war. I don't want to sound like some complacent academic type when it comes to dangers of China, but in sheer economic terms, the U.S. remains supreme in the world.
Let's talk for a moment about Afghanistan, a really interesting situation that you talk about in a very recent column. And as, of course, most of our listeners probably know, the United States is scheduled to withdraw the last of its outright military presence in Afghanistan on September 11th, interestingly enough. Your column explores kind of the current political situation in Afghanistan, which involves what you characterize at one point an odd couple that is managing to create a scenario of shared governance that
amazing. Two principal political rivals in the election, reasonably honest and open elections and national elections, apparently, especially compared to Afghanistan before this century and before 9/11, which had no elections of any real consequence, women are participating in very, very substantial numbers in the political system, which is a true revolution. But the odd couple of the two principal political leaders who emerged after the election, Ghani, the president, the defeated candidate, contested they finally worked out a deal, which is very positive and impressive. They were pragmatic for a change. So they do have shared governance, which is working.
You also say in this column that the ongoing peace negotiations between the Afghanistan government and the Taliban have been going on now for months. You, like many observers, are actually rather amazed by that. I think you're amazed that there are any negotiations at all, and further amazed that they've been as persistent as they have been.
Yeah, they don't seem to be going very far or anywhere. In that sense, it's reminiscent of our ordeal in Vietnam, where the National Liberation Front, the revolutionaries in the South, and the North Vietnamese, the Hanoi government, which ultimately won the war, it was very, very hard to get them to the negotiating table. And then from 68 until 71, 72, they were just extraordinarily rigid. In other ways, Afghanistan is a total contrast with Vietnam. I think we're right to withdraw. We're not there unilaterally. We are part of a United Nations-sanctioned international force. There, the British, as usual, have been extremely effective and faithful allies of ours. And the Turks, interestingly enough, given the bad relations between Ankara and Washington, again, militarily very, very effective, but the Turks have been very supportive of this effort, partly because of their understandable fear of extreme fundamentalism, despite the religious nature of their current government. We're certainly right to withdraw, and I think there are things that we can do to try to secure our position after we leave. Well, the Taliban is gaining ground, but it is essentially, fundamentally, the Afghans' business. Excuse me, I interrupted you.
Well, I was just going to say, I know in your column you mentioned that although we are withdrawing militarily, that other kinds of aid to Afghanistan will continue even after September 11th.
That's right.
I think that's probably what you're getting at when you say that we can continue to solidify our connection to that country.
Yeah. The Taliban is primitive in literal terms, almost medieval, very, very effective military organization. It's important to keep in mind that no one has ever conquered Afghanistan. The British tried very hard in the 1800s. They had three unsuccessful military expeditions. One entire army was literally wiped out in the 1830s, except for one man whom the Afghan warriors allowed to live because they wanted him to carry the message down to the transport ships at the seacoast in South Asia that this is what we've done and we'll do it again. The British, as usual, are instructive. By the 1880s and 90s, they had established a modus vivendi through bribery, through selective use of military force, through divide and rule, at which they've been very good historically. They were able to maintain influence in Kabul. And I think we should follow the same approach. There is no one has ever conquered Afghanistan. Various writers, including Robert Kaplan, a kind of Victorian traveler who goes to the he has literally sat around with Taliban warriors in the steeps and interviewed them and survived. He and others write graphically of the fact that in Afghanistan today, everywhere on roads, in fields, you see knocked out Soviet tanks, just endless numbers of these big heavy Soviet tanks and their big heavy helicopters that crashed and burned in Afghanistan. They were there throughout the 1980s. The most recent example of the fact that you can't conquer Afghanistan by force. But it is highly decentralized, and I can assure you CIA and other American operations will be active in Afghanistan. We certainly should be. And insofar as we can develop sympathy among local warlords and among the female population without putting them at risk, they're not going to go away. And you can't engage in mass torture and murder of the sort that the Taliban and others have done. Now, you can't keep that secret anymore, per our discussion of Cuba. So I think if we show restraint and are smart and don't resort to firepower unless we really have to, and so far as we can be un-American, if I can put it that way, we can maintain influence in Afghanistan.
Right. As you've said more than once, you know, patience is not, generally speaking, the chief of our virtues as a nation.
No, but Eisenhower, perhaps a uniquely subtle president and general, he regularly reminded people of patience. Patience is a form of courage. Regarding Taiwan versus China, the courage to be patient. We had two confrontations in 55 and 58. Over offshore islands, Chinese shelling offshore islands and threatening Taiwan. He was so good that he kept the first crisis pretty much out of the news completely, and the second almost so. They were at least as serious as the Berlin crisis of 58 to 61, and almost as serious as the Cuban Missile Crisis of 62. But he was always saying, let's be careful and let's be patient, which is very hard for us Americans to do.
We're speaking with Dr. Art Seer-Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College. I hope we have time to explore a really interesting column in which you recently wrote about the nature of 21st century monopolies versus the monopolies of maybe a century or more ago. But one of the things that you give us in this column is kind of a laundry list of various points of litigation that Apple and Epic Games are involved in a big struggle, that Amazon is being sued, Google is being sued, Facebook is being sued, and in almost every case, these involve matters of monopoly, of anti-competitive practices by various firms, and of course most of them, as we're touching on, are kind of in a particular sphere, the information sphere of our economy.
And those are the growth areas. They're also the biggest and most profitable corporations on Earth today. Think of it. It's the information, not railroads, not steel, not concrete, not the tangible industries that used to be dominant, or big commercial banks. Excuse me for interrupting,
yeah.
But that you're getting at a really crucial point.
So what your column tries to explore is a little bit about what is the nature of these perhaps monopolies now.
Yeah.
I mean, like, what is Apple doing right now, or Facebook or Amazon? In what ways are their practices similar, but also in what ways are their practices different from, for instance, when Standard Oil got in trouble, or AT&T or whatever?
Yeah.
So in a nutshell, what would you say is the biggest difference, and what is sort of the, what do we have to be careful about with these sort of modern day monopolies?
Well, they don't control our lives. They can be insidious in terms of collecting information and running algorithms that, to a remarkable degree, will gather information, the old-fashioned totalitarian dream, on individual citizens. Big corporations have a lot of information about you, about me, about Dave McGrath and the other office, about each and every one of our listeners, that is disturbing. That's nothing new. The advertising and marketing industries, especially after World War II, started collecting information that was very, very detailed. But it's much more far-reaching and kind of an invasion of privacy. But we could live without these corporations. I do believe it argues for regulation and investigation, and as usual, that's where Congress really excels, and our federal government, along with those of other nations, and increasingly international regulators. But you could survive, you and I and others could live without these corporations. I know, living without my cell phone, living without the internet, believe it or not, it can be done. You could not live, human beings could not exist in any kind of civilized life in the United States from the end of the late in the 1800s, unless Standard Oil, the greatest monopoly in history, mm-hmm. at least in the industrial age, wanted them to. John D. Rockefeller and Associates developed total control of kerosene, which was a basic fuel in this country for lighting and cooking, starting around the Civil War. And petroleum, they could shut down the manufacturing in the United States. They could effectively shut down the U.S. military, at least the Navy. Hmm. They really controlled the American economy.
Wow.
And that has not been the case since. You referred to AT&T. After World War II, basic manufacturing seemed to, there was kind of a hiatus on anti-monopoly legislation during the New Deal, when there was emphasis on corporate cooperation and organization. But communications became a target after the war, along with the computer industry. The federal government went after AT&T, as you implied, starting, I think, in 1969, and eventually broke up the company. And the company reemerged, you know, like a multi-headed hydra,
yeah.
And you could cut off the heads, but they reemerged. And starting, I think, with Southwestern Bell, AT&T is back. Mm. But they did have a concentration of power that made it healthy, in my opinion, for the government to break them up. The government went after IBM at about the same time, and this company, Apple, reemerged, emerged from nowhere, from a garage, with Steve Jobs and his tech buddy Wozniak. Mm-hmm. Apple grew so quickly that eventually the Justice Department gave up the suit against IBM because, in fact, it was no longer the kind of monopoly. They were, in fact, a complacent corporation that almost went broke. Mm. These companies perform a very useful function in terms of, I think, American values, especially overseas. They empower the individual at the same time they're monitoring them. Google deserves credit for showing a lot of courage in China. I'm very sorry that following Mr. Jobs' death, Apple sold out, and they're collaborating, in effect, with the dictators. But Google has been steadfast, as far as we know, in opposing the extremist, very vicious behavior of the Beijing regime, and they are still banned in China. We ought to commend Google for that, but they are so big and powerful, they are a threat. But it's not John D. Rockefeller in Standard Oil. Also, Rockefeller, of necessity, was a hell of a lot smarter in terms of his political skill than the business geniuses now running these corporations. Mm. If you go back and look at the history, he was regularly hauled before Congress. With very high-stakes legislation in play. Rockefeller was always polite. He never raised his voice in any of his business dealings. He was never arrogant, and he also knew far more than any single congressman or senator or civil servant who was interrogating him. You compare that with the arrogance of Cook, for instance, at Apple, or the Facebook guy, or
Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah,
right, absolutely.
So I'm reassured by the fact that these characters, extraordinarily talented businessmen and women, they don't seem to have the kind of modesty that ensures survival. But I'm just a professor.
And a very good one. So as the hour draws to a close, we're about to join NPR's coverage of the first day of hearings by the House Select Committee investigating the incident on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol. I'm just curious, what do you make of this investigation that's going ahead, and what kinds of matters do you hope that they will explore?
The nature of political extremism in this country. I myself hope that President Trump remains former president, doesn't run again, and doesn't win again. I think the January 6th riot, it was not really an armed insurrection. The only person killed, thank God, there was only one, and it was a demonstrator. It was a riot, not unprecedented. In 1971, I believe it was the Weather Underground, bombed the Capitol. We have had violence directed at our capital historically, but in our time, this was really quite unprecedented, was criminal. And it'll be a chance to highlight the large number of people who have been identified, thanks to the pervasive media we've been discussing, and are being prosecuted. Once the federal government comes after you, some of these simple fools are already getting a good education. And the fact that you don't want to mess with the federal government, you do serious time and you do real prison time. So in that sense, the system's working. Insurrection, I'm mindful that NPR especially applies that term and a lot of other people. You want to talk insurrection? In 1877, railroad, industrial, petroleum workers who couldn't take it anymore because the Rockefeller cartel was squeezing them so hard. They were taking wage reductions if they were lucky enough to keep their job. There was an insurrection that started in Pittsburgh. Railroad stations were occupied. They were burned. Railroad yards were torn up. Railroad cars and locomotives were burned and exploded. The local guards and thugs that the Rockefeller organization employed were overwhelmed. A number of them were killed while killing workers. The National Guard was called out in Pennsylvania. They finally disintegrated because they were partially overwhelmed, but also just were unwilling, a number of them, to kill workers who basically, they were violent and aggressive, but they weren't an armed force. The federal government, finally, federal troops put down that insurrection. Now, that's an insurrection, my friend. What we faced on January 6th was a terrible crime. It was not an insurrection. And we got to be careful in our safe and comfortable world of America today not to overreact to threats, problems, even disasters that we face.
Fair enough.
It's good. That's what Congress does well, you know, investigation, self-righteous declarations, putting people on the spot, including the Capitol Police, as long as they're not turned into after-the-fact victims, why the response wasn't better by the security authorities. Putting Trump to one side, that's a question that I hope they seriously address in Washington.
I do too. On that note, that's where we have to draw things to a close. Dr. Art Sear Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy at Carthage College, and our monthly guest on The Morning Show. I appreciate this conversation and look forward to talking with you again.
Always a pleasure and a tonic. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, the monthly visit of Nan Calvert. With her will be P.J. Leash, who is from the Entomology Diagnostic Lab at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We'll be talking about what one can do in one's lawn and garden to attract the beneficial insects that we need